Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out tonight. I'm Pastor Tim Westermeyer, Senior Pastor of St. Philip Deacon. It's our privilege and pleasure to host these community-wide events, and we're so glad you came out tonight. If you're joining us online, we'll have a word for you in a moment. It is a beautiful day here in Plymouth, Minnesota, and to all of you, I'll just say you're welcome. Because it seems that whenever we have a Faith and Life event, the weather turns beautiful. And so I'm grateful you came out off of a beautiful day. To those of you joining us online, we're delighted that you are here as well. I'll just give you a little context and history. This is the 22nd year of these amazing community events. So for 22 years, we've been bringing in people from all walks of life, historians, scientists, executives, nonprofit leaders, bloggers, authors, doctors, some theologians, but not many theologians, but they come to talk about how Christian faith intersects with whatever it is that they do. Tonight I'll say a word about our speaker, who is maybe the first person who's coming from his particular line of work. But before I do that, I will let you know that after he speaks, there will be an opportunity for all of you to ask questions. So if you're here in the house, in the sanctuary, I'd invite you at that time to go to one of our mics to my right or to my left, where you can ask a question directly. If you are joining us tonight digitally, then you can either write a question in the box underneath the live stream that you're watching on the Faith and Life website, or you can send an email to social@spdlc.org. social@spdlc.org, and we'll try to get those questions answered as well. So our speaker, before I introduce the speaker, I do like to ask the question as well. Are there any people here tonight who are at their first Faith and Life event? Okay, excellent, wonderful, quite a few of you actually. So thank you for coming out. We're particularly grateful for your presence, and I imagine we have a number of first-timers online as well. So tonight's speaker began his work in youth ministry and college ministry, where he discovered that a lot of the work that he was doing was counseling. And he may share some of this story. He decided perhaps he should do some schooling to learn more about what it means to be a counselor, and he couldn't stop that, and so he ended up getting a PhD, and he has been now a counselor and therapist for many years. If you've been to these in the past, you will know that in addition to the traditional biography, I also like to share something a little bit off the beaten path. So I had the great privilege of hanging out a bit today with our speaker at another event at noon in South Minneapolis, and we were chatting about this. And it turns out he likes to run and to bike. He and his wife Lisa, who is also here, when they were raising their children, went on a bike ride. Has anyone been on a bike ride where you have a sag wagon? You know what that is? So that would be where you bike from one point to another, and some other third party brings your car and all of your accessories to the place you're going to end up. Does that make sense? So the story he shared was perhaps one of the most interesting examples of the body of Christ, which I think he's going to talk about tonight. They were going to do a trip on bike with their three children in Michigan, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right? And so before they left for this trip, he just had the idea, well, I'm going to call some churches along the way and ask the secretary to point me to some faithful, honorable, trustworthy people in the congregation who can drive our sag wagon for us. And so he arranged all of that, and four or five times they went to a congregation, they found the person who was going to drive their van for them, and apparently it all worked out just great. So anyway, I think I love that story as an example of one of the many ways the body of Christ can support ourselves and one another. So anyway, thank you for coming out tonight. I am delighted to present Dr. Thomas Wagner.
Thank you. Thanks, Pastor Tim. That was from the Lake Huron side over the Crown of Michigan and then over to Charlevoix. So did that trip, and Lizzie was like 12 years old, and so we had to sing Disney songs to keep her going 50 miles or whatever. What Pastor Tim didn't tell you was that prior to all that stuff, I studied to be a Catholic priest for 6 years, and I could never quite get the knack of celibacy, so I went ahead and I left and got myself married with some kids. prior to that, actually, I had two experiences where a fire hose of God's love just hit me right between the eyes. And when you're a Catholic boy and that happens to you, you just think, I guess I better be a priest, I suppose. So when I left the seminary, pastor's right, I got involved in what a person can do with theological training, which was to be a youth minister and then a campus minister. And along the way, I picked up my counseling skills and got a doctorate. And my research has been in the area of resilience all along for nearly 30 years. I've just been amazed at what people can do who have no business doing it. People you'd never think could be good at being married, but look at this. Lifelong happy marriage. People with all the strikes against them, and look at them. You know, they're continuing to go forward. In fact, that's maybe the way to think about my topic, which is resilience. To not think of it in a restricted way, but in that more general way that, like, captures all of what resilience means. And so, you know, like Katy Perry saying, if you get knocked down, that resilient person, what do? They stand back up. You know, they bounce. At times, resilience has to do with that kind of flexibility, and in others, it's that grit that holds firm, too. It's all those things. And I've discovered over the years that there's something in the DNA of our culture that just loves that story of the person that was dealt that bad hand of cards and looks at him, and rather than throwing him back in and giving up, they hold on to those cards and see what they can make out of them. It's as if we all know by heart that song by Kenny Rogers. You know how every hand's a winner and every hand's a loser. It just matters how you put those cards in play. Because one thing's for certain, Good Friday's coming for all of us. And we like nothing more than to study those stories of people who find a way to hang in there, to find a way to Easter Sunday. A good resilience story. We hunger for those. If you were to ask any one of my seven siblings about a good resilience story, I just know for sure they're going to tell you the story of my Grandpa Harry, whose life wasn't that unusual in his coal mining town of Athens, Illinois, just north of Springfield, Illinois, until he turned about 10 years old, because that's when his dad decided that he would go ahead and just leave the family for good. And if that wasn't enough, and that left his mother with three kids to earn a living as a woman could back in those days, who knows how, taking in laundry, cleaning houses, taking boarders into her house. Well, a couple years later, my grandma, Grandma Lizzie, she developed this deep cough that they called pleurisy, but it was tuberculosis, and it took her life, which meant that at 12 years old, my Grandpa Harry had to go to work in the coal mines and leave school. In the stories passed down to me, before there were safety regulations, why, if those coal mines were flooded with ice-cold water, you didn't get a day off. And by the time he was in his teens, my grandpa would have seen many people who were crushed or died in explosions in that mine, some of whom he knew quite well. Now, when I was 12 years old, let's just say that I wasn't working in any coal mines, and I wasn't supporting my three younger brothers. What I was doing in those 1970s at 12 years old, I'd come home and park myself in front of that colored television set we were real proud of after school, eating as many Hostess treats as I could get in my mouth, watching those consecutive episodes of 1970s sitcoms, you know, Partridge Family, Gilligan's Island, all that stuff. But then what would happen is I'd run out of snacks and I'd have to get up and go reload. And on the way, I would pass this china cabinet which held the sacred objects of my family. One of those sacred objects being a lamp that would have been down in those coal shafts to light the way for my grandfather. And here's a memory I had at 12 years old, standing there looking at that and just imagining, what was it like? What was it like to be Grandpa Harry at 12 years old? And then I would remember why I got off my couch, and I'd shake myself and I'd go get more Hostess treats and I'd go back and watch my shows. I'm not 12 anymore. I'm pretty far from it. And I've raised three 12-year-olds of my own. So my questions about that life are a little bit different. When I look at that life of my grandpa, I ask myself this, what was it like on that day at 10 years old when the guy who's supposed to play catch with you, the guy that's supposed to bring home the paychecks, is gone, just gone? And what was it like when the love of his life was just snatched out of the family, just snatched out of his life? What was that like for him? And then I wonder, what was it like when those nights became darker than those shafts that he occupied during the day? And I wonder, who held Harry when he sobbed at night? Who rocked him? And sadly, I think I know that answer. Nobody. And when you contemplate a life like that, and some of you know lives like that, it's not hard to resonate with that quote from Helen Keller when she said, "All the world is full of suffering. All the world is full of suffering." And for people in the audience at home and for we gathered here, people of a certain age, don't you somewhere inside just want to say, amen? That's right. All the world is full of suffering. But here's the thing. That story doesn't end right there. Because just a few years later, Harry would meet this cute little Polish girl with a knack for cooking, and he married her, my grandma Francie. And together they raised two boys of their own. So check this out. Without a role model, with fidelity and affection, my grandfather raised two boys. And if that's not enough, every story about my grandpa Harry converges on this point. Apparently he had a laugh that would start somewhere down here at the base of his belly, rumble up through his chest, and by the time he released it into the world, it had rattled the silverware on your table. And not only that, but he laughed frequently. He laughed loudly. I've seen pictures with his mouth open like this, laughing into the world. That guy would laugh. And I've heard his laugh in the throat of my own father. I think I hear it in our kids. That guy laughed. Back to Helen Keller. I only told you half her quote before. All the world is full of suffering, she said. You want to know the second part? And all the world is full of overcoming suffering. And all the world is full of overcoming suffering. Guillaume Apollinaire, that great poet philosopher, put it like this. Come to the edge, life said. Come to the edge. Oh, but we're afraid, we said. Come to the edge, life demanded. We came to the edge. Life pushed us, and we flew. Life pushed us, and we flew. So for this little bit of time I have with you here tonight, I want to talk about the experience of being pushed and the experience of flying. I want to talk about resilience. Now, something I've learned over the years is I'm not the only resilience researcher. In fact, just about anywhere you go, you'll find that people really care a lot about this and research it on their own. There's a little bit of a resilience researcher in everyone. I have found a useful place to start is to ask people to attend to their own resilience research as mental handholds and footholds into this material. And I'm going to have you do that right now tonight to like visit your own wisdom. And we're going to do this in kind of a fun way. What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to close your eyes and I'd like you to picture someone who's very dear to you, that is very warm when you think of them, that you're very personally connected to, not a distant stranger or somebody you read about, but somebody who's been in your life, either deceased or still alive, a grandma, a grandpa, a mother, a father, an aunt, an uncle, a friend, a coach, a teacher. I want you to pull up in your mind's eye that person that when you think resilience, you think that person. And maybe the face you're going to see qualifies as resilient because they're that zany sense of humor because they can find a laugh around any corner. Or maybe your person is resilient because of their their creativity. They open the fridge and they don't see leftovers. They see a gourmet meal. Or maybe your person is just really loving. Or maybe like my grandma, it's just unflappable. You know, you can't make that lady not smile. So go ahead and picture your person. And I'd like you to see them in a little movie that maybe you remember. Just see them in action. doing that thing that makes them so resilient. See the beginning of it, the middle of that movie, and the end of it. Just let that reel run right now. And if you're at home, just picture what I'm asking you to do. And let that movie come to a conclusion. And when you're ready to open your eyes, I'll be here waiting for you. I love the smiles on faces when you're thinking of that person. What I'd like you to do if you're at home is what I want the folks here in church to do. I want you to turn to a person either on your left or your right and try to keep it to just two of you if you can. If necessary to be in a threesome, fine, but we're better off one-on-one because I can't spend a lot of time on this. I want you to tell the person next to you the story of this person and what was so resilient about them. If you're at home and you're with someone, tell that story to the person you're with. If you're not, write your story down and resolve to tell it to someone dear to you as soon as you can. You got the directions? On your mark, get set, talk. About another minute. Okay. One more direction. Try to summarize that quality of the person. How would you put it down into a word or short phrase? What's so resilient about them? How would you say, here's the characteristic? If you ask me, I'd say my grandma, and I'd say she's unflappable. That'd be the word I'd pick. What is your signature word that you would use? Tell your partner that word on your mark, get set, go. All right, and now, I'm going to ask for just a few hands to go up. I'm going to be looking for about three people, like one here, and one over here, to tell me, just to raise your hand, and I'll call on you, and I want to hear about who your person is and what's the word that you chose. If I were out there and I raised my hand, I'd say, my grandma, unflappable. That's all I need to hear. The relationship to the person and what's the word. Would somebody please raise their hand? Otherwise, I'll call on you like teachers do school children. Any brave person? Yes, up front here. What is your first name?
Allie.
Allie? Okay, Allie. Who's your person?
My sister.
Your sister?
Courage.
There's courage to her. Okay. Let's go over here. Is that your hand up? Yeah. I'm sorry? I thought you were raising your hand.
Grandfather.
Okay. What is your first name, by the way?
His first name?
Your first name?
Carl.
Carl? Carl. And your grandpa. And what's the quality?
Visionary.
Visionary. Huh. Okay. And back here?
Phil.
Phil.
Father.
Father and present. Okay. And you all got to get the benefit of the stories that go with these words. I want to share with you a trick I've played on all of you just now, kind of a Jedi mind trick that counselors can do. And rather than just tell you what the trick is, let me give you some hints and see if you can guess at it. So, if you're going to find some valid, reliable research in my field that comes from developmental psychology, you couldn't do any better than looking to see into those experiments on attachment theory. So what we've learned is that when a baby is being fed, they're drinking way more than milk or formula from the caregiver. They're actually swallowing the caregiver themselves psychologically and spiritually inside, and that caregiver becomes part of their psychic and spiritual infrastructure. And so what we say is that when a child's gotten good enough parenting, they swallow that caregiver inside, it becomes like a home base. And we'll say that that child develops good enough attachment. So when a child like that goes to school and they walk up to the first person and they say, "You want to play?" And they say, "No." And they go, "Okay." Then they go to the next person. "You want to play?" "No." They're able to find that resource inside to be okay to go to the next person and the next person. A child swallows way more than milk, way more than formula when they're being fed at the hand of a loving caregiver. Well, what we learned about babies and toddlers, we know now, is true across the lifespan, which led St. Clair of Assisi, St. Francis's best friend, to say this: "You become what you love. You become what you love." Check that out. And that's why the psychologist Jesus in John chapter 15, if you, depending on your translation, you're going to hear these words, "Remain in me." Or maybe your translation will say, "Abide in me." Or maybe your translation will say, "Make your home in me." Over and over again, "Make your home in me, and in that way I'll make my home in you," because Jesus knew you tend to become what you love from the inside out. Do you see what I'm getting at here? Well, what I'm getting at is that Allie over here says she's got this sister that has courage. Guess what I just learned about Allie? Allie's a woman with courage. Because you tend to become what you love. And you tend to notice out there the value that you're already carrying inside. Carl has got a grandpa who's a visionary. There's something of a visionary sitting in that pew, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 rows back. You're saying as much about yourself as you're saying about that person when you say that. You tend to become what you love. Phil, your father was present, you said? Is that what you put? Yeah. You care a lot about presents, and you give that to people, don't you? I should probably turn to the person next to you and ask that question. You see, because you tend to become what you love. So there are some implications that go with this. One of those is, some of you, I know what you're thinking, "Yeah, but they had this much." But I want to say, even if you have a mustard seed's worth, you can grow that. So taking ownership of that gift that you just now noticed in yourself by noticing it in the other person and deciding to grow, that is one implication. Here's another one that's just a little theological footnote. Seems like such a radical thing in those Christian denominations that have communion or Eucharist, but the idea of Jesus saying, "Consume me," is not really that radical at all. It's a thing that we human beings are always doing all the time, taking each other inside of ourselves like this. One more implication. In my field, there's a thing called narrative therapy. One of the things a narrative therapist asks a client to do is to be clear about the audience you want to carry with you in your head as you do difficult things. You don't want to be picking people, imagining people who are going to be critical of you, like somebody you might have internalized who is not a good enough person to love you. You don't want that as your audience. You want to pick as your audience very deliberately and think about those people like that grandfather or someone else. And what'll happen is you'll find yourself talking like that person. You'll find yourself acting like this person. Again, you tend to become what you love. I'd like to put this into a Christian framework and say there are these communion of saints that we can ask to pray for us, and we can carry them inside us as we go into things. Because united with God as they are conduits into the divine, but they carry a face with them that makes it easier to take it in. So attend to who you bring with you. One more thing. It's true, we tend to become what we love, but we're also shaped by what we hate. So in this day and age, is anybody here going to disagree with this? Be very intentional about where you place your attention. Failure to be clear about where you choose to place your attention will erode your resilience in our times. And this is where I want to shift into my research. You've gotten a chance to attend to your own research. Let me share some things. Well, actually, I want to share one key finding I found in my research. And as I do reviews of the literature of other people's research, this quality in resilient people always rises to the top. Before I share that quality, let me tell you, one of the things I've learned that's good news in resilience research is that this is not a genetic trait, resilience, where some people are lucky enough to win the lottery and be born with it, and the rest of us slobs just wish we had it. Resilience is more like a muscle that you can work on and work out with and make it bigger for yourself. And that's what I want to talk about. One key finding I found that shows up everywhere about how to go about that. But instead of just tell you that, I think a more powerful way is to start with a story that gets at it. I'm convinced that the shortest distance between the human heart and the truth is a story. So I want to begin with a signature story that Lisa and I experienced early on in our marriage. I was a late bloomer because of all that, will I be a priest or not a priest? And so by the time I finally got married, I didn't want to dilly-dally too much about having other kids. So Lisa and I decided that we would go on the kind of vacation that you can take without kids, but once you have your kids, you can't do that. So we went to Las Vegas. No, we didn't do that. We didn't do that. No, actually what we did was I called up to Ely, Minnesota, since we didn't own any camping equipment, and I found an outfitter so that we could take a trip on the Boundary Waters. Now, people at home, if you're not from Minnesota, the Boundary Waters are a whole connection of a bunch of lakes between Minnesota and America's 51st state, between the two, which I think we should probably start calling Upper Minnesota now. So we got there, they got us our equipment, they got us the canoe, and they took us to the put-in place and said, now, you be back here at such and such a time, on such and such a day in a week, so that we can take you back to civilization, because at that time, no cell phones. And actually, in the Boundary Waters, even now, I don't think there is cell phone connectivity. So we launched ourselves, and I had this romantic idea that if we looked for our own private island, which meant that we had to paddle and paddle miles and miles to find it, why, maybe we could have marital bliss under the stars. And then I learned pretty quickly that in Minnesota, you grow mosquitoes the size of softballs. So the marital bliss part, not so much, but it was a good vacation. And when the vacation was coming to a close, Lisa and I were remembering we got to get back. So we packed the canoes, but we realized we have some extra campfire coffee and a little extra time. So we sat down with a little cup of coffee and our novels, and we're taking the last sip of the vacation. And we start noticing by and by that this milky white sky is starting to turn kind of a blue-black. And there's a little green in it. And we're like, we can't wait this thing out. We got to go. So we put our remaining things in there, and we launched our boat at about the time the heavens launched the rain in buckets on us. Then came the wind, and we noticed it was driving the rain horizontally into our faces while it's lifting up white caps. So now we're paddling with each pull as hard as we can, because if we don't, we're blowing backwards. Pulling, pulling. I'm not sure if it was Lisa who said it first or I said it first, but one of us says, beauty check on the right. So we look to the right, this gorgeous stand of pine trees, paddling as hard as we can. Beauty check on the left, bouquet of flowers that's gorgeous. Beauty check on the right, oh my gosh, is that a moose? You know, along the way. And we made it all the way back. I guess that's the end of the story. Happy ending, right? And Lisa and I to this day are convinced it was those beauty checks that gave us the power and the hope to make it. Well, come to find out, There's some research that backs up what we were doing, Lisa. Lawrence Gonzalez researched subjects who had survived nature accidents to see how they did it. And one of the things all his subjects had in common was they did beauty checks. Not his words, those are my words, but it amounts to the same thing. So he tells the story of one of these survivors who said, "I had a broken leg. I'm clawing my way down the Himalayan mountains. I'm separated from my team. And I wake up in the morning and I look down into that valley. I'd never seen beauty like that before. It gave me the hope to continue to claw my way down the mountain against all odds for survival." A woman he interviewed who had a shipwreck. She was out in a life raft, hoping against hope that she'd be rescued. She said, "The nights became so cold, I'd be shivering in my boat." And she said, "From my seat in hell, I could see heaven. I'd never seen stars like that before. That gave me the warmth to shiver through one more night in the hope of getting rescued." Resilient people, they do their beauty checks. By the way, the word beauty. Before the Enlightenment came right around the 16, 1700s and Descartes came along, we didn't divide things up so much. And so the idea that God has some synonyms that we don't usually use so much anymore. One of God's synonyms for God's name, guess what it was? Beauty. What our Christian ancestors believed, our Judeo-Christian ancestors believed, was that when you experience beauty, you are experiencing God reaching out toward you. When you're quickened to have a look, that's God from within pulling you out to have a look. Same goes with love. Same's true for truth. Same's true for goodness and integrity, that it pulses within and pulls you out to do the thing with integrity, goodness, love. And those words, by the way, they're interchangeable. A thing's beautiful because it's true, and it's true because it's beautiful. So here's the way the story continues with Lisa and I. Glory be to God, we were able to get pregnant with our first daughter, and it might have even been on that trip. And I know she's probably watching me on TV and going, "I'm so glad my dad said that." And a few years later, after a miscarriage, we gave birth to our second child. And then years later, we'd come Lizzie. But when the second one came, why, Lisa had to start her residency. And in those days, the way residencies worked was that frequently you were in a rotation where every fourth night you were going to work a 36-hour shift on call at the hospital, frequently getting no sleep at all. If you're lucky, maybe 1, 2, 3 hours of sleep. Then she'd come home and fall asleep, wake up the next day and do her usual 10-hour days until the next fourth day, and she'd work her 36-hour shift. For my part, it was time for me to finish my dissertation. So I cut my workload in half, and I stayed home with the kids. So when they were napping, I was doing dissertational work. I'd like to think of myself as that father. When the child stumbled out before their nap was over, I would get on the floor and play, but I was not that dad. I'd get back in your room. I've got to study. And get those restraints back on. I didn't do restraints. But it did. That was an era where it felt like the wind was blowing the rain horizontally into our faces. And we did feel like if we weren't paddling with all our might, we were being blown backwards. Thank goodness Lisa and I remembered to do our beauty checks. If Lisa could come home with a little bit of consciousness and I could get the kids down, I'd pour out a glass of wine and a snack and we'd say, "We're on a date." If I could put food with that, we'd say we're in the most exclusive restaurant in St. Louis. If we could get an afternoon off with the kids and go to the zoo, we'd say we are on vacation. What I've learned by reviewing research, this shows up in everybody's research and my own as well. Resilient people, they have this characteristic that I'll call it a defiant intentional positivity. And it can look like this. For people who are in a relationship with cancer that they wish they didn't have, positivity can look like there are cancer-free zones in our house where we don't talk about cancer. You want to talk about cancer, we go to this room. That kind of positivity. It's a positivity, that intentional, defiant positivity of a person with depression who's able to kick their feet over the side of the bed and get up and do the next thing. It's positivity that looks like that. It's defined differently for each person, but it's that decision that I'm going to do the next right thing that increases my chances for what I'm hoping will happen next. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about Pollyanna when I'm saying positivity, because the other thing about resilient people is that they're also very realistic. If Lisa and I were looking out at that lake and a funnel cloud was forming, I'd like to think we wouldn't go, well, let's go. We'll just do our beauty checks. No, no. Positivity without realism is dangerous. Realism without positivity can immobilize a person without having hope. You can become cynical, because today's cynic was yesterday's idealist. Positivity and feeding that somehow is really important, which is what I want to shift to. How do we go about growing that kind of a muscle where I can do those beauty checks in my life in a realistic way that has positivity with it? To get at that, I want to share with you what I've noticed in little children. It seems like every mother's child is wired to come in the world to be able to do this. So a toddler happens upon a butterfly's wing, and what do? They stop whatever else they were doing, and they focus all their attention on that butterfly wing. They pick it up and they flap it. They might rub it against themselves. They might taste it. They might flap themselves. But the whole world is that butterfly's wing, and they're in awe and wonder over that. Now, the thing that happens, though, is that that child turns into a 6-year-old and a 7-year-old. And there comes a day when they step out of their bedroom that's full of toys and art supplies and books, and they say this, "I'm bored. I'm bored." And before we laugh too much, how many of us are like that 7-year-old, driving past sunrises or sunsets, looking past some tableau of beauty in a grocery store between a grandparent and their grandchild? How many of us fail to notice it and to do our beauty checks? What I'd like to suggest is we have to look for a way to do what that philosopher Foucault would call have a second naivete, where we return back to claim our birthright that we've left somewhere along the road. How can we do that? For that, I'm going to reach back into our Christian tradition to the 16th century. Ignatius, who lived in Loyola, developed this technique. I'm not even going to tell you what it is, because if I say it, well, it's called the examen. The problem with me saying the examen is that in my Catholic tradition, people recognize that as a way to think back on how you've goofed up so you can feel a lot of guilt. That's not how Ignatius meant it. I want to show you how he meant it, but what I want to do is give it an update from somatic psychotherapy, which is a fancy way of saying, how do we bring our bodies into the experience of gratitude? That's what I'm looking at. Marty Seligman, a colleague of mine, noticed that with his research subjects, if he got them to do a gratitude list, their depression measures would decline. So would their anxiety measures, and the happiness measures would increase over time. Even 6 months later, they would notice that. Anybody in a 12-step program is going, duh, we've known that for 70 years in AA and other programs. A gratitude list goes a long, long way. Let me show you the way that Ignatius wrote about it with a little update. Are you willing to do this? Is that worth your while? Okay. Then I'd like you to close your eyes again. As you close your eyes this time, I want to wake up your imagination. This is a form of contemplative spirituality that's known as using images to get to God rather than letting go of images. So I want you to get in touch with your imagination. I want you to start off in a room where there's nothing too interesting in that room, except you notice that there's a door. And because I asked you to open up your imagination, just study the door a minute. What's it made out of? Is it a big, thick door like you'd find at a cathedral with that kind of iron work on it? Is there a latch that closes it, a doorknob? And you might even rub your fingertips across the wood grains, or if it's a human-made product, and feel the particles of paint. In just a second, when I ask you to open that door, I want you to bring your body with you, because you're going to go back in time to a moment of great well-being for yourself, a time when, say, something dramatically good might have happened, like a new person came into your life. Maybe that person came out of your body even. Maybe it won't be so dramatic as that. Maybe it'll be like this powerful conversation you had that wouldn't stop going into the night. And by the time the conversation ended, there was a relationship that changed for good. Or it could be something even further back in the contradicting, booming, banging, buzzingness of childhood. There was a place you used to go to, and when you were there, all was right with the world. In just a second, when you open the door, you're going to return to one of these places. Or it could even be when you thought you were walking up this hill on a camping trip, you summited the hill and you realized that you were actually on a peninsula with water all around, and that feeling that can only be described as awe entered you. I want you to select one of those moments in your life that you'd say is up there in the top five. And I want you to open the door and bring your senses with you, because the first thing I want you to notice when you push that door open is to see what your eyes see as you step back into that place and time. If it's an outdoor place, just check out the colors that you notice, the shapes and the forms. Is there movement, like wind through the trees, or an insect or a bird? If it's an indoor place, just look at that room you've stepped into again. What's on the walls? What's on the floor? Is there a way where natural lighting from outside through the windows commingles with the human-made light? And as you're looking, are you sharing the space with someone else? And now, whether you're in an indoor or an outdoor place, close your eyes and just listen to the sounds of this place. Is there a human voice that's distinctive? Or a human voice you only heard that time? If you're in an outdoor place, are you hearing wind blow through pine needles or leaves? Are you hearing water lap against a dock or a shore? Are you hearing birds or a plane overhead? If it's an indoor place, what are you hearing there? Again, human voices, the sounds in that room. Take a deep breath in of the smell of that place. That distinctive smell of that indoor place, or that distinctive smell in this outdoor place. And now I'd like you to pay attention to that sense on the inside of your body. What are you feeling on the inside in this place of well-being? Try to allow yourself to use more poetic words to describe what you feel in your chest, in your shoulders, in your belly. Is it kind of an open skies blue feeling? Is it a warm feeling like a fire almost? Is it a color like a orange feeling, a green feeling? Is it like butterflies or like something moving inside? Just pay attention to that. And if you allow me this indulgence, I'm going to ask that slowly, slowly you raise your chin to look up. Because what I want you to see in front of you is the divine face smiling at you with the kind of smile that seems to say, I kind of thought you'd like that. And see if you can execute a smile back and in your own very personalized way, express some gratitude. All right. And just as soon as you're ready, you can open your eyes. This is what the examen's about, is stepping back to enter into a moment of grace. This more long way of doing it is great for a retreat. You can do this with the joyful mysteries of your life and return to those kinds of moments. Or you could pick some of the sorrowful mysteries of your life to go back and re-experience where the gifts were and the graces were in the hard times. Now, I mentioned Marty Seligman and his research on gratitude. I prefer the word savoring because I think it's more of a whole body experience. When we savor something, you know, like a cook that's eating a chef's meal, it's like they don't want to swallow it, they just want to taste it. You know, they want the way the acid is balanced by the oil and the sweetness and the saltiness. They just want to see the textures in their mouth. Or that mathematician that solves that problem just sits in awe in front of it, savoring, look at this. This is the music of the universe. Or the physicist that sees that beauty. Just to savor it is what we're looking for, to savor our lives. Brother David Stindl-Rast puts it like this. At any given moment, there's always something that you can savor. How could he say a thing like that? At any given moment, there's always something you can savor. The reason he can say that is he is a brother in a tradition of Christianity that believes that all the world is shot through with God. What we want to do is develop the eyes to see, the ears to hear that grace that's available every single moment. What David Stindl-Rast also said, well, and there's one more thing he believes, that all the mystics of our Christian tradition believe. And that is, if you took all of the Christian tradition, the Bible, the Torah, the prophets, you know, the wisdom literature, all the writings of our holy men and women, and you put them in a big kettle and you boil it down and down and down, what you'd be left at the end is this essence, really just one sentence. And here's what the sentence would say. It would be a sentence from God to you that says, you know, I'm really quite fond of you, except for it would be more over the top than that, like this. I'm crunchy, munchy, crazy in love with you. Not the whole human race, really just you. I've never done this before. G.K. Chesterton said it's like this. God didn't create a whole world full of daisies. He created one daisy and fell in love with it and had to make another and fell in love with that one and then another. And before long, the world's covered in daisies where no two of them are exactly the same. That's our God. And so God's trying to reveal beauty, truth, goodness, love to you. If we can develop the capacity to take it in. And the way we can do that is through these savoring practices, savoring our own life in the moments every day to do this. The other thing that David Stindl-Rast says is that at any given moment, there's something you can savor, which isn't the same thing as saying that every single thing you can be grateful for. You cannot. Some things are evil. There are some things that just cannot be savored. But right in the midst of that dark time, you can savor it. In the words of Lucy Hone, a colleague of mine who's a resilience researcher, she lost her 12-year-old and her best friend in a car accident. She said, the thing that got me through was the practice of gratitude through those dark times. It was like a lifeline that pulled me through. So in the darkest of places, you can look and you can find that, and it will give you just enough hope to take the next step. I know something about this because something like that happened in our family. Lisa, my wife, is from northern Wisconsin, as was the rest of her family. Their speech patterns are very much the same as people from Minnesota. So it's kind of delightful to be with you guys and hear you speaking that way. It's like, makes me nostalgic for her family. For years and years, we would gather the family on Thanksgiving from the four winds of the United States. And they would come to our house and we'd kick our children out of their beds on the second floor. And they would stay with their cousins in the basement and stay up way too late and have fun. Well, during these gatherings, it wouldn't be unusual for my mother-in-law, who thought she was a clandestine smoker, to leave into the garage and have her cigarette. I thought she must have thought a breath mint would take care of it. But we knew what she was doing. Well, this night before Thanksgiving, there she is doing that, and we're not noticing that she's been out for four cigarettes worth of time, because we're all like having adult beverages and the kids are playing and I'm making my pies. I look out the window and here comes an ambulance. And before long, it's pulling into my driveway and I'm noticing those lights are illuminating my mother-in-law's form on the ground. And they're also, those lights are picking up, they're flashing off of a gathering pool of liquid underneath her. An ambulance ride later and a CT scan revealed that she had a severe brain injury and she would die. I ask you, was there anything good about that worth savoring? No, there was nothing good about that worth savoring. After I made sure my wife and father-in-law, everybody was set, I went out to the waiting room to check on my kids. My son, who's 6'4", at that point, I think he was like a freshman in college, maybe. He was just like a pressure cooker ready to explode. So I took him out of that waiting room and out onto the street. And with that, he became a fire hose of profanity, just pouring it all over the buildings and everything else, kicking garbage cans, hitting signs. And by, I was able then to gather him into my arms and he began to sob. At that point, he folded that 6'4" frame over me, and he fell asleep in my arms. He hadn't done that since he was a toddler. I ask you, is that worth savoring? From my seat in hell, I could see heaven. John Harry will never forget that, neither will I. A moment of grace in the midst of the worst possible thing. The next night, we were to say goodbye to my mother-in-law, and we decided to do it in pods of each child that she had with their family would go in and say goodbye. While we were waiting our turn, my wife, who's a physician at Children's Hospital and knew the secret way to get up to the butterfly garden on the ninth floor that overlooks the city lights of St. Louis, and we went up there together. And as if she were the child and my kids were the parent, she dissolved in tears into their arms. And as if they were the parents and she were the child, they held her like that. Again, from our seat in hell, we could see heaven across the city lights. In that moment, God's breath blew through that, and the grace that turned little boys and little girls into men and women, thanks to the vulnerability of my wife, they were transformed. A grace was right there for those with eyes to see it. What I'd like to suggest is a daily practice where you go back and do the very thing we did a minute ago. Can I give you a taste of it? Are you with me still? If you weren't, would you tell me? You wouldn't be Minnesota nice? All right. I'd like you to close your eyes one more time. But this time, when you pass through a door, you won't be going back years and years. You're going to step back into some experience you had in the last week where someone did something kind for you. Like maybe your wife mixed that cup of coffee just the way you liked it, or maybe your husband did that tea for you just the way you liked it. And they had a look on their face like they meant it. Or someone told you they loved you and they meant it. Or a dog's slobbery face was parked on your lap, and somehow you sent God's love in that little creature. Or perhaps something was turned in at work and you could almost hear the Indiana Jones music in the background. Just let yourself go back now, or you did notice some physical beauty in nature. Or in the grocery store, a relationship between a parent and their child that was blessed. I want you to step through that door again, and this time go back to that moment and just soak it up now. With your eyesight, see it again. With your hearing, hear it again. If there's something you can taste, taste it again. If there are arms around you, feel those arms again. If there's a hand in your hand, feel that hand. And savor it. Let yourself feel it in your body. And this is something I feel strongly about, so if you could humor me and just raise your chin up a little bit and see that divine face with that smile that seems to say, I kind of thought you'd like that. And express your gratitude. And then just come back. Look at the smiles. It doesn't cost a thing. I mean, it's costing your pastor something to have me here. But you doing this costs you nothing. So what I'd like you to do right now, because this is such a short time to get into this content, there's much more to share. I'd like to deepen this and extend it. So I'm going to put a slide up right now. But before I put it up, would you please do a thing you never do in church? Please take out your phone. I want you to have your phone in your hand right now. Humor me. I know it's kind of goofy. Someone in a church sanctuary is saying, I want you to open your phone. Because what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to take that phone number and I'd like you to dial it, because I want you to text to that phone number your email. Because if you do, what's going to happen is tomorrow morning, first thing in the morning, you will notice that I'm going to send you a video where you can join me on my porch, where we're going to extend what we're doing here. You'll just have like a 3-minute little meditation I'll lead you in that'll deepen this and extend it. And then for five consecutive days, you'll get more of that. It'll never be more than 5 minutes, somewhere between 3 and 5 minutes. See what you think. I think you'll really enjoy this. So pull that up. Got it? And even if you don't feel like putting your email in there, act like you're doing it, so at least I'll think you did it. And I promise I won't share this with any marketers or anything like that. And if you see one of the videos and you think, what is wrong with that guy, and you don't want any more, you just cancel it. Don't do it. But I think you'll like it. You get to join me on my back porch in my backyard. Got it? Any questions? You're just texting to that number, your email address, and we'll meet again that way. Now, there are many more things to say. I still see some people working on this. If you're a young person and you're near an older person, can you help them? I say that as if I'm a young person. No. So, the genius of Ignatius was this. What he knew is not many of us are very good at going, oh, there's God right there. I feel it. Not many of us are great at that. What it takes for a lot of us is that retrospective look back over our shoulder to go, ah, that was a beautifully kind thing. I can savor that. And in savoring it retrospectively, we can more and more get the feeling of what God's fingerprints look like in the now moment. So that like Marlin in that Finding Nemo movie, remember how he was looking for the Eastern Australian Current so that he could get whooshed to Sydney to find his son? Well, what Ignatius knew is we have the Eastern Australian Current inside of us. If we can learn to identify it retrospectively like this through some discipline, through a spiritual discipline, to stop, drop, and savor, then there'll come a day when in the moment we'll notice. We'll notice how what used to get us hooked, we're not hooked. We'll notice we can step into that flow and whoosh more readily and more peacefully in our lives. Warren Zevon, the great rock and roll artist who wrote Werewolves of London, was a favorite of David Letterman. He was on there a lot, and I got to see him the very last time he was on when he had cancer. And David Letterman was such a wise guy back in the day. He didn't know how to handle this, but he knew he was cutting to the commercial break, and this guy would never be back. So he said to him, Warren, is there anything you would like to say to America? And Warren said, actually, David, yes, there is. He said, America, make sure that you enjoy every ham sandwich. Make sure you enjoy every ham sandwich. Like any great musician, he knew the music is between the notes. Listen to what he didn't say. What he did not say was, if you get a chance to have lobster, you better enjoy it. If you can have a filet mignon, go for it. No, enjoy every ham sandwich. Because what a man in his position knows is there's no such thing as ordinary. You know, Mary Oliver would say, this one wild and precious life you've been given that's irrepeatable, it's not ordinary at all, even though that's what it seems like. Stop, drop, and savor the sacredness of you, the sacredness of every drop of your life. That is the key to resilience. That's the key to resilience. That's the key to finding hope in challenging times.
Thank you, Tom. As I mentioned, you're going to have a chance to ask some questions. I know we've received some questions online. If you would still like to send in a question and you're at home, again, email to social@spdlc.org or in the box below the live stream. And when I'm done making some announcements, I'll have Tom come back up to answer questions either online or from you here in the sanctuary. So, first thing I will say is time moves quickly, doesn't it? The fifth and final event in the 2024-2025 Faith and Life season will come up in late April with a gentleman named David Brooks, I imagine many of you have heard of him. I don't know if I will include this in my introduction of him, but among his many achievements in life is that he is probably the person that I have been chasing the longest to come to faith in life. Way more than 10 years, probably 15 years I've been trying to get him to come. So he will be here on April 24th, 7 p.m. I hope you'll join us for that, either in person or online. If you'd like to be reminded of that event and future events, feel free to sign up for our emails or on social media. I also, as always, want to be sure to thank people who make these events possible. It is the Faith and Life Series is a community service of St. Philip Deacon. It is not part of the budget item of the church, however. And so it is supported 100% and has always been supported 100% by the incredible generosity of individuals and corporations. So I will just list or name some of the organizations that support us and underwrite us: Crossroads Financial Group, Cressa, Mally Design, Mastercraft Labels, The Valuation Group, Productivity, Rapid Packaging, and Bay Creek Dental. And then you see the names of many, many individuals. Some of them are here tonight. Some of them are watching online. Will you join me in thanking them for allowing us to bring people like Tom here? I also want to, as always, thank Jeff Elstad, who is our guitarist. So thank you for your music, Jeff, before and after these events. And a final word of thanks tonight. Perhaps in the last 22 years, the question that I get asked more than any other is, well, Tim, where do you come up with all these great speakers? Sometimes there's not an easy answer to that. Sometimes there is. And in the case of tonight's speaker, there is definitely a very specific individual, Dr. Eliza Thompson, who's here right there. Eliza is my niece-in-law? Is that what you are? She's my nephew's wife. She studied medicine at Washington University in St. Louis, where she got to know both Tom and Lisa. And we were at a family event, I think last summer, when she said, you know who would be really good for your series is this guy. So, Eliza, thank you for the suggestion. I feel deeply like I'm forgetting to say something else that's really important, but I can't remember what it is. So I'm going to sit down now, and Tom's going to come back up. And if any of you are brave enough to come up and ask the first question, please go to one of the mics. Otherwise, I will ask a question from online.
You weren't chasing after me for 10 years.
Sorry?
I guess you weren't chasing after me for 10
years. Well, I didn't know about you till last summer, or else I would have been.
So when it comes to the online questions, I assume those will show up somehow.
I've got them. So I will actually I'll kick us off with one of those. And apparently my online editor back there told me earlier that I'm quoting here, the chat is on fire. So
I love the way kids talk these days.
That's right. Anyway, okay, this is the first question from online. If you had to name a patron saint of resilience, who would it be?
Oh, my. Well, I already said my Grandpa Harry. Mm. Patron saint of resilience. Like a really alive saint? The person who's
named
saint?
That's what the question says. I think you have discretion.
I mean, just take your pick.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, that's why they are saints, I'm guessing. So I'll have to give that some thought. For me, the saints I like are the ones that I have known personally. So, yeah, I mentioned Harry. Hold on a minute here. Well, I mean, my spiritual mentor for like 20 years, David Fleming, the way he dealt with his cancer, it was a really horrible cancer, but goodness gracious, he put a cot in his office so that he could continue to edit Review for the Religious. So he found great meaning in his work, so he didn't give it up. He just kept going and going. So that would be a patron saint for me, yeah. Hi, person.
Hi, I'm Michaela, pastor of Family Life here at St. Philip the Deacon, and I have a 15-month-old son. And so when I think about helping him build resilience, he's only got 15 months and not the yet capability to do an examine. So what is your encouragement for us parents of how do we build resilience in children. Based on your presentation, my first thought is, every dinner, can we ask what they're thankful for today? You know, where was a moment of gratitude? Yeah. What do you savor today? But do you have anything for even when they're really little?
Yeah, yeah. So you love this little person? See, that's the best pre-evangelization I know of. If you're going to talk about a God who's crunchy, munchy, and crazy in love with you, and you never met anybody who's in love with you really early on, it's going to be a pretty hard leap, isn't it? So that part right there is the core of all of it. But the next thing that you were intimating that I think is brilliant, look at your rituals and traditions as this child is being raised. Some of the things that we tried to incorporate would be at the end of any vacation, circling the family up, and popcorn style, just start noticing the things on this vacation that were awesome. And there'll be laughter, and they'll be making fun of each other, and it'll be popping up like popcorn, and they'll be saying the same things like this. But a moment like that, that this gratitude practice is not unusual. It's a thing we do. I like, we used to do a thing where we'd do a morning offering on the way to school in the car, where we'd ask them to say to God out loud, what's something you're looking forward to and what's something that's a challenge for you? And to pray that out loud. And what that did for us is at dinner time when you'd say, so how was your day? Fine, you know. Instead, you'd know what to pray for at that dinner time. And so if they're not going to have the words because they're an adolescent, doesn't want to talk, you're able to voice it for them, you know, that how that went with that paper or that talk or that whatever. So I think your instinct is right on. Just wherever you can fold love in, you know, wherever you can do that, you can get so much wrong as a parent. If you get the love right, it's going to work out fine. Yeah. Do you find that when you walk into the stores about parenting, like there came a point where it's like, I don't want to see any more books like that. Because they're just kind of like, here's how it's going to ruin your self-esteem as a parent. But if you get the love right, you know, you really work at that. I think that's important. And do you love your husband?
Oh, yeah.
That's it. Keep falling in love with him. You know, that builds resilience in children. There's no two ways about that. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, while the next person is walking up, again from online, I have a friend who has hit some rough times. How can I assist her in being more resilient?
So let's get clear about something. I've got a friend that's something of a, he hates the word resilience because he thinks it's synonymous with pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. What I've found is that's just the opposite of resilient. Anybody that you know who's achieved anything, anybody who looks psychologically buoyant or spiritually buoyant, they're only buoyant because of these hands that are holding them up. None of us are resilient by ourselves. None of us are. So that you're asking this question, person out in internet land, is really important, that I want to be there for that person. It was Gordon Lightfoot that wrote about rainy day people. I'm going to be there. And when you are there, don't be afraid to have nothing useful to say. Just your presence is really the thing. You talked about, you're a man who cares about presence. Just showing up, you know? Get together a grief support group. Everybody's going to have the story about what the idiotic person said in the line at the wake. It's not important what we say. It's that we show up and we give a good hug and that we're there to hear the story. And then when the story gets old, keep showing up. You know, like that. One more thing, because I'm a psychotherapist and a resilience researcher, when I'm trying to be a good friend, I really don't want to be talking like an expert. So I want to be saying things like peer kinds of things. Like, what have you noticed that works here for you? What have you noticed that hasn't worked? You know? If I can, if it's beneficial to share something from my own experience, I'll do that too. Yeah. Over here?
You named a number of different songs in your talk tonight. What hymn or other piece of music speaks well of your message?
Oh, gosh, what a great song. What hymn or other song speaks well of my message? You guys have interesting questions. Well, let me just almost anything Van Morrison wrote. You know, his Into the Mystic, I think, is just a profound song. I tend toward those songs that don't mean to be Christian, but they are. You know, that's why I like Van Morrison. James Taylor writes crushingly beautiful music. Joni Mitchell, some of her things, they just touch me, make me want to cry when I hear them. So those are what's come to mind. Be Thou My Vision would be a hymn I think is just so profound and beautiful. Am I in the right ballpark for you?
I was also thinking, Great is Thy Faithfulness.
What were you thinking of?
Great is Thy Faithfulness.
Yeah, okay. So I should have just turned it back on you and said, what's your favorite? And you would have done that. And then I would have said, me too.
I'm not getting paid for this tonight.
Yeah, good point. Good point. That's a good point. Maybe you should.
I'll go with O Day Full of Grace.
Okay. With what?
O Day Full of Grace.
O Day Full of Grace. I'm not familiar with it. I am a Catholic boy. Eliza, do you know that one? All right. There is your aficionado of hymns. You should get together with her afterwards. All right, so
I'm going to ask another online one before our next person comes up to the mic. What is the difference between resilience and patience?
Resilience is a bigger umbrella term, and patience fits into it. Here's a thing, a little known fact. Resilience research and happiness research are about the same thing. The things that make people happy are also the things that make them resilient. So patience is a virtue that will make you more resilient, but there are many other ways to describe virtues for resilience.
Okay.
With your first assignment, when you asked us to think of somebody who, like you tend to become what you love, my first thought was my mother. Calm would have been the word. And I think in her 98 years on this life, or on this earth, I never once heard her raise her voice.
Oh my.
But do you ever use that as a marker? Because you said that these people probably were that. I think I almost look at her as a marker as how far off base my life has gotten sometimes. In that I would describe my life as total chaos right now sometimes internally. So I was just curious if you ever see that, just, you know, the one thing you would strive for that you actually don't have?
It's an interesting question. How frequently is it, you ever meet somebody that's like, talks about how humble they are? You know, the fact that you're aware of where you're not meeting the mark makes me think it's a value for you. You know, and at any given moment, I'd like to interview this 98-year-old woman to talk about how calm she was feeling in every instance, you know? I think you probably have more of it than you think you do, but you want to ask yourself the question, when do you find it easiest to access that calm that's in you? Do you know answers to that kind of a question? And when do you find it harder? If you're going to grow that some more like your mother, you might want to find out, like, who are the people I'm with that tend to anchor that for me? And who are the ones that don't? What are those practices through the course of my day that grow that calm in me? I've built up a habit now for 3 years that I always thought I would do, but I never did it because life wasn't ready for me to do it yet. I'm sitting for a contemplative sit in the morning for 20 minutes and then at night for 20 minutes. And it's amazing the impact that's having on me slowly, slowly, slowly. The times where I'll be calm where I wasn't before. Before a talk like this, I might wake up at 3 a.m. and look at the ceiling before. Now I go back to sleep, you know. And being a dude of a certain age, you know, the bathroom calls, but then I can go back to bed, you know. Am I in the neighborhood of something useful for you?
Absolutely. I think,
okay.
As we said, we probably know, but we need to practice. It's always an ongoing practice.
That's probably really the right answer, isn't it?
Meditation.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to think the boy, she's calm, I'm not. It's more like, okay, so how can I root and anchor what's in me here? How can I do that? One more thing that people from AA are great at, that Jesus says, I give a peace the world can't give. And I always wanted to say to Jesus, well, if you don't show me how to access it, what good's it going to do me? So finding out what are those little practices that give me that conduit down into this underground, unlimited aquifer of peace. What are those practices that get me there? And what are the ones that don't? I think that's the resilience trick. Now, here's the fun part. I don't always get to speak unplugged to audiences. A lot of times I'm having to use language like mindfulness and meaning. I'm having to use those synonyms for God's name, beauty, love, goodness, truth. Today we just get to talk about, here's what our Christian tradition says. And I get to be upfront about that. How do I access that peace that was promised? A question?
Well, I'm going to call last question, and this is online again. And by the way, after I ask this and he answers it, then I'm going to walk up and I'm going to give him a gift, and then you can applaud wildly, okay? So we'll see if you can follow that instruction. Don't applaud after he answers the question, because then I'll have to shush you
so
when I give him the gift.
So may I make a suggestion? If you could applaud so wildly that when David Brooks is here, he'll be like, there's nothing compared to
okay.
that Dr. Tom Wagner.
Okay, this is related to the
David
last.
Who?
What's that?
David who?
Yeah, whatever. This is related to the last conversation we were having, which is, what do you notice is the benefit of a regular resilience discipline?
Oh, gosh. The difference between being awake and asleep, it's the difference between being in a car going through a beautiful scenery and it's all passing you by like a television set, you know, as compared to being on a motorcycle or a bicycle in that same scenery. You are like Zorba the Greek, you know, taking life in fully and drinking it in. That's the difference right there. Resilience as understood this way, of savoring every drop of your life. That is the key to resilience.
Beautiful. Nicely done. So thank you all for coming out on a beautiful night. To those of you joining us digitally, thank you for being present. We hope you'll see us. We'll see you later in April. And Tom, for you, we have a little parting gift.
Oh, nice.
It says, with thanks to Thomas Wagner for bringing faith to life. We are so grateful you were
thank
with
you.
Us. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Tim. This is beautiful.